Hello, and welcome to Navigating Nursing. I am your host, Laura Whitehead, a registered adult nurse, a critical care nurse, qualified lecturer, and fellow of the Higher Education Academy.
And I am joined today by Georgina Cox, who is an Associate Professor and Director of Programmes for Nursing Associates and Apprenticeships at the University of East London. Thank you so much for joining me today, Georgie.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for having me. It's only taken us 2 years to get around to this.
But we've got there. That's what counts. I should give a disclaimer right at the beginning that we're very loud laughers, so you might need to turn your volume down slightly. So Georgie, I'm going to take you right back to the beginning. Why did you decide to study nursing? Why did you want to be a nurse?
Blame my mother. I had done, I'm showing my age now. I'd done O-levels, I'd done A-levels. I had gone to uni briefly, believe it or not, to study biochemistry. I was bored within about a month and I came back.
That was the limit.
And it was, while I was doing it, I kind of figured out that that wasn't for me and I wasn't really understanding it. So I then started running a video shop. And these are in the days of Blockbusters. For those of you that you can remember, I had a little private video shop I was running. Mum walked in one day and she's like, you know what, this is not all that you should be doing with all those qualifications, as mothers do. And she said, you know what, you're good with children and you're good with animals, cats and kids, you should be a nurse, she said to me. And I was, video boxes in hand as I'm restacking shelves, like, what cats and kids? She's like, yes, let's go to the job centre and see what they say. So I was like, oh, okay then, Mum. So off I went, toddled at about 19 at the time, I went to the job centre, and in those days the job centre had those little Cardexy things with the little, well, I don't know what size that is, that little tiny thing that they had, those little squares with all the lines, and you just looked up on it, so it's like nursing on the top of this little card. And it told you what you needed. And then it said, you know, you just write to your local hospital. So it wasn't quite on UCAS yet for nursing. I'm traditionally trained, so I'm a vocational qualification. I'm pre-Project 2000. I'm like the last of the final vanguard from St. Mary's Hospital. But before that, I had written to several places. So you wrote, you got called for interview, and off you went. And there I met quite a few friends, actually, that you probably know. So big shout out to David Ring and to Beverly Brathwaite, because we all trained together at St. Mary's. Me and Bev were in the same cohort. David was, like, I think, about 6 months after us, something like that, or a year. And it really was about distance. So I went to Guy's, went to Tommy's for interviews, went to Hammersmith Hospital, because it was separate then from Charing Cross. And it was about journey time, really, because I'm a London girl, born and bred, Northwest London, and Mary's was actually the most easiest route for me to do to get in, because I had already got my flat, and so I wanted to keep my flat, of course, and then travel in, I was on the 6 bus route straight in. So got on the bus one end, got off the bus the other end. That's what I like, straightforward. First thing in the morning, in for a 7:30 shift is all I was thinking about. And so I went into adult nursing. I did apply to Great Ormond Street for the combined programme. They contacted me about 2 years into my programme.
Before I started. Wow, that's a turnaround.
To tell me that I had been considered and I was accepted, and that they could take me in like 1991. Now, when I had applied, which was in the 87.
And I had started
4 years later, and I was already qualified by the
time they got back to you.
Yeah. And I can imagine Great Ormond Street was really popular. I did enjoy my PEDS part of the training. So I'm a traditional RGM. I'm a registered general nurse. So that second year in the traditional way of being trained, the apprenticeship style, you actually did all the specialties. So you did mental health, you did child paediatrics, you did midwifery, you did care of the elderly, you did A&E, and you did theatres.
Did you know from your training, did that help you pick where you wanted to work when you were newly qualified?
Kind of, and kind of not. Kind of because I really enjoyed orthopaedics and I enjoyed cardiology medicine. So my journey, as soon as I qualified, well, actually before I qualified, I kind of knew I wanted to teach. And I also knew that when I heard about Project 2000, I knew that nursing was changing. So I knew I needed a degree, and what was I going to teach? And I always had a fascination for physiology. Hence, I went to Westminster Uni for the 3 years. So literally, I finished in August, and September, I started uni. And those were the days when you got a bursary as well, when you went to uni. And I had my daughter while I was training, see me very fast, do everything all at once.
Efficient. Get through the life goals.
had my daughter, separated from my husband, started my degree, and finished the degree 3 years later. But I was part of the nurse bank with St. Mary's. So when I was listening to some of my friends going, got part-time work, went down the pub, it's not really really badly paid. There was five of us who were nurses that were qualified on my degree course.
It was a group of you.
There was a group of us. Different areas that we'd come from. We wanted to do physiology degrees. And we were like, bank, good in it. So you're actually earning some money, decent money, while you were a student. And I really enjoyed my student days, I have to admit. But then when I knew that my time was coming up to finish, I went into trauma orthopaedics, a D grade, and then I moved into cardiovascular surgery with high dependency unit. I learned to transduce CVPs like you could not believe. And it was eye-opening insight. So I did 6 months on the orthopaedics, and then I did 9 months with the cardiovascular. It was really interesting because then we had a really forward-thinking sister who brought us the HDU, and that we could we would fast track people through. And if ITU had people who were not quite ready to go to the general wards, but not quite ready, so we were kind of like the step down between. So we got a lot of sick people, and my god, I learned so much. You wanted, and that was a good thing about the physiology degree. It gave me an insight into actually what the doctors were thinking and what happened.
And I think one of the things with working within the MD team, because our education is so different, you sometimes don't know as a nurse what perspective they're coming from. And sometimes it feels like on ward rounds that certain or all doctors or any members of the MD team, their perspective or their focus can be so different to what you're worried about. And you're thinking, why are they asking me about this? I'm really worried about the fact that he hasn't passed urine in 6 hours, or his blood sugar's this, or why are we focusing on the HB right now? Or, you know, whatever the scenario is. That's something that I learned from going to intensive care, was learning that almost that medical model, and them learning a bit more of the nursing model, and kind of having that middle ground between the two.
100%. And that did give me a different perspective. And I think one day one of them said, oh, so sister, and I was like, no, I'm the staff nurse. And this consultant sort of stopped and looked at me, and I was like, what? And you're absolutely right. It did. It gave me an insight I couldn't believe. And no one at the time actually understood
what that was.
So after that, the next post came up as a senior staff nurse and a deputy ward manager. So then I moved on again, and it was cardiology, male cardiology. Then we got changed to female cardiology. So then got night experience. It's when I started doing my teaching masters. I was part of the team. We did this like cannulation and venipuncture drive. So all nurses had to be able to take blood and put cannula in, and all healthcare assistants learned how to take blood. And I'm talking like early 1990s, mid 1990s, we did that. And we all did that at Mary's. And then I started doing night cover one night. I don't know why I was asked. And they were like, yeah, Georgie's done whatever. She can cover the hospital. There are only like a few wards. That was an eye opener. I can tell you that. And then that became part of like one of my regular routine, that if they didn't have cover night managers, I would cover the unit. And I got lots of experience. And then there was an incident when they got a new manager, and I was covering for my manager who was sick. And eventually, because of how he was towards me, and I'll say he was a racist, you know what, and made it very obvious that he didn't like me. And on the first day when we had a meeting, and I was saying, well, you know, what we're going to do, staffing, etc. I was told that even though you're a deputy ward manager, that was not for me to do and I shouldn't be attending the meetings. So I was like, fine, okay, I won't. And 2 seconds next breath later, looked at my white counterpart and said, and we'll see how soon we can get you into a navy blue uniform, shall we? And so at that point, I thought, you know what? I'm off ski. I'm not sitting here putting up with this. And I kind of did a down to tools, work to rule. The management couldn't understand why I was doing what I was doing. And then we had a meeting, by which time I'd had been shortlisted, had an interview. As usual, my best mate would look in the magazine like, that's your job with your name on it there, George.
Oh, how nice.
And then off I went. I went off to Charing Cross. I had 3 years as a ward manager, which by the end of it, I didn't want to be a nurse anymore. Nursing is hard. That's probably one of the most thankless jobs, I would say, is a ward manager's job, because you're not quite full management, but you're not quite one of the girls anymore.
Yeah, between the two.
Yeah, and that's really, really hard. So I do feel like managers. I was one of the only black ward managers that they had at that time, if you can imagine. And it was interesting, where you learn management, but you don't really learn management. The fact that you are the budget holder, you are in charge of 28 beds, you are in charge of 28
And that's not something, you know, within our training or anything. No one's telling you how to manage a budget or how to look at staffing levels or managing long-term sick or performance management. And that's something, then when someone takes over that role, that's just, oh, this is part of your job now. And it's massive, isn't it? To expect all of those skills.
Huge. And we had 24-hour responsibility. So people would ring you at home like, oh, sister, I can't find this form. Look in the drawer, top
it's like
right.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning.
But you learned how to manage that. Voicemail becomes your best friend at that moment
put
in
the
time.
Voicemail on. Did you find it, like, going from that situation with that really horrific racist colleague, did you find then when you went to your new role, did that dent your confidence or did that impact on you and your practice?
No, it just made me even more determined. You are not going to stop me from what I'm doing and what I'm doing, because I know that I'm good enough. Yeah. And as some of the things that I know that I'm hot stuff. Yep, I was determined that, you know, I was on my pathway. And that's when I started looking into more teaching roles, didn't get them. Then I got a call from Thames Valley University, as it was. And the lovely Penny Russell invited me, as I interviewed first time, and then she invited me back to interview. And I always remember in my interview, she had one really interesting question that stayed with me the rest of my whole career. And she asked me, was I a nurse academic or was I an academic nurse?
Ooh.
And I stopped, because I was sitting there thinking, oh, they're going to ask me all about, I don't know, stepping on, stepping off, the latest essence of care and all the rest of it. So I'd read all my papers and I was up on it. I was so ready for it.
You were ready. You'd done the prep.
And she came up with this question. I was like, I thought, I don't know. I said, I was a nurse, first of all. And then I went to learn my physiology to help me understand my nursing better. I said, and then I got into teaching. I said, so my nursing always comes first. I would have to say I'm a nurse academic. Mm-hmm. and not an academic nurse. And then I looked at her as if to say, is that right?
Is that right? Yeah.
Just a question is all she said.
Oh, my God. I'm going to have to have like some serious like identity like think this afternoon. You've just added a whole other thing in there. I've been going between, am I a nurse? Am I a lecturer? Where am I between the, am I a student? I'm studying. Who, where am I between these three? You just added like a whole other level to the.
Now, if you ask me now, I would say I'm an academic nurse now because my clinical time is less, whereas at that point, my clinical time was really strong. And then the McPherson report had come out in late 1999 because 2000 I moved into teaching. And I'd have to say, like I say to everybody, I learn something new every day in nursing, and moving into academia was no different. I still learn something new every day, whether it's from me directly, from what I'm learning myself, or quite frequently, it was what my students then started bringing back from the things that they'd learned.
I have it with loads of our students in mental health because I've never worked in that area, so... For someone to come and, you know, experience on the wards and intensive care, but not actually going to a mental health unit and working, you know, and some of them are in really high psychiatric intensive care units, really high acuity, and loads of the policy and the care and the assessments that, that are then brought to class. Yeah, we don't know, do we? We're not in every field, in every area of speciality.
No, not at all.
That's really important to remember. You've said about, you know, moving into academia, and you've completed two masters. So you're a very academic person. And I think
now.
That's something that I think right from the beginning, I think you can tell that if you talk through your career, lots of nurses might shy away from owning that or saying, I'm an academic person, I'm interested in academia. I think maybe they might be intimidated by kind of owning that as part of their identity.
Now, it's really funny. We talk a lot now about CPD, continual professional development, don't we? And for me, they were always like, oh, what are you studying now? Or what are you doing now, Georgie? And I was like, because there's something else to study. There's something else to learn. And actually, that's the groundwork of our profession. If we're going to move forward, if we are going down these academic lines, and that was the first thing that I thought back even in the 80s as I was training and getting ready to qualify in the early 90s, as soon as we said Project 2000, it was obvious that the genie would be out of the bag.
Yeah.
And we are still having this stupid debate, sorry, very strong feelings about this. You know, should they be nurses having degrees?
Literally. It makes my... There was an Tory MP not that long ago that said it on the radio, didn't they? Yeah. I've got nice people in my constituency that have applied and not gotten in. And I think part of my brain just started to leak out of my ears. And why? Why out of our whole profession, out of everything that nurses do, why is that something that no one goes, does a doctor need a degree?
No.
Does a solicitor need a degree? Does that engineer need a degree?
Does a podiatrist need a degree?
Yeah, the physio, the soul, the dietitian. I really don't understand. Is it because people don't understand what the role of a nurse is? So they can easily say, well, you don't need a degree to do that, because they don't actually know what the day-to-day is. So it's easy to discredit it, where some people can guess what an engineer does or a lawyer, you know, that can kind of, most people can have a little bit of an idea. But because nursing is so broad and it's so diverse,
absolutely,
that no one's got a clue, have they?
No. And the thing is, it really is, you know, from band one to, what are we now, 11 or something like that and beyond? You could be as basic as, or I should say as a general ward nurse, which is a jack of all trades, and even that in itself is a specialism, because to be, you know, I'm an RGN, registered general nurse, there are how many specialties that I got taught within that you could pop me in and I could work and function, to yourself, which is intensive care, forget that, I've seen what ITU looks like now, and that's like leading Starship Enterprise, you know, you might as well turn me up and put me on the, you know, Star Trek Next Generation. That's what you're like in comparison to what I did when I did HDU. You know, Now it's the monitors are like a quarter of the size, probably still the same way that you transduce CVPs, very similar.
But I imagine the cables are probably still the same.
You know, and you looked back then, and I'm thinking, wow, I was saying this to my dad the other day. I was like, it's 2024. I said, I remember when I was a student looking at bags of fluid saying expires 2020, thinking, wow, am I still going to be around? It's 2024. That fluid's done expired. But it's so wide. You know, you could be a nurse consultant. You could be a consultant midwife and have all your own practice. You can do that. You know, we take bloods, we cannulate, we prescribe. You have your own practices. We have aesthetic nurses. So, you know, you don't like this, go and have a quick nip tuck and we can sort that out for you in a few crow's lines to, you know, you've got a colostomy.
Partners in GP practices and there's a whole,
you know, it's completely different to us who are like the academics who are meant to be doing all the research. And we're getting doctorates, etc. And so now you're saying doctor nurse. And that's just, it's a huge difference. So I don't even know why we still have that argument, because to me it's a moot point. You don't decide that, would you want somebody who's not an engineer to put a building up?
Yeah.
But your own body, you would be happy for somebody with no qualifications to look after it. And when you're sick, they remember.
But it's not until then. It's not until they've got that personal lived experience, I don't think.
Yeah.
And it's almost seen as a crowd pleaser, isn't it? Oh, we'll just raise this as a point and then everyone can, I don't know, can kind of join in, but they don't have the background.
So we're not having that.
We're not having that. We're really not.
No.
And you've done a lot of work throughout your career in different kind of forms, looking at equality, diversity and inclusion. Do you mind just talking about some of the work that you've done with Hairdin and Sharedin while you were at Middlesex University?
Well, it started from just a tiny little group of us meeting up. I think if you'll find Sheila Sobrani, who's now the president of the RCN, she was the brainchild, but the rest of us got together with her, one for all for one type of thing. And that was long before Mr. Floyd happened in America, that got everybody all up and angry. But our students were talking about what they were seeing. They could see that there was inequalities and they didn't know the people who were winning prizes. And so we started to look at that as an academic group. But then while we were in the academic group, some of the academics said, that's great that we're helping our students, but what about us?
Yeah.
You know, what are we doing to help us? And so from that little acorn and that bit of research that Sheila carried out, which is that I think something like one in five of our students, something like that, spoke three, maybe four languages.
Yeah, wow.
And English was like their third or their fourth language. So, you know, a lot of diversity in there, to the point that we then went all around the campus. I went around the country, met people, and we started being part of the first Middlesex Anti-Racism Network. We worked on policies, put some research bids in, didn't always amount to anything, but hey.
Hey, you got to put the bids in. We've got to throw the hat into the ring to see what happens.
Put the bid in. And again, learn a lot within those last 3-4 years that I was there at Middlesex. The networking, the linking, and to actually know it's not an isolated thing. The Hairdin, Sharedin, that racism experience some of our students are actually going through. And I mean, for me, you know, my bugbear, I've got locks, was always about the hair and the things that people could say about hair, and how people can use the policies to persecute someone. But it's when one of my students actually came up to me, and I remember I was in my link area and he was quite upset. He was a first year. And he was saying to me, Georgie, is it true I have to cut my locks? And I thought, well, who's told you that?
Yeah.
I know the person in common who was always saying when I had one around my link area, so, Georgie, you've got X, Y, and Z. And I was like, you don't worry about me. You worry about consultant so-so who's still running around in that bloody coat that he's had since he was a fifth year med student. You know, I'll take my rings off and I'll take my jewellery off and be bare below elbow. But actually, I'm not part of the team. I'm just a visitor.
Yeah, and I want to live in patient care. I'm here to see a student in an office.
Yeah, but, you know, completely different. And I said to him, you know, what was said? And basically, two lads sitting next to each other, one black, one white, one with locks, the other with long hair, told the white student that he needed to tie his hair up, told the black student he'd have to cut his locks. Why would you say something like that?
Yeah, why would you?
That just doesn't pan out. Having said that, I just said to him, you know what? Looked at his locks and I said, looks like you do a re-lock. You know, you're going to be off to the hairdresser. You know, I can tell by the product that you use on your hair because it's got a particular scent. Who does your locking when you go back? Just make sure you get one that's above the collar. So he went off and I went in to see him then on the Monday or the Tuesday the next week. And he was there on the ward in his brand new starchy uniform and his hair
bright
was
white. Gone, he's ready.
Bright white, yeah. If he stood out of it, it would have stood up by itself. And his hair was beautifully coiffed and off his collar. And he's now a charge nurse. But we could have lost him just because of somebody's thoughtlessness. Now, if that was overt racism, I don't know. Is that because of lack of insight? But if you just think about the things that you said, immediately, straight away within the vicinity, it was like me with what that person had said about it wasn't my role to do this, but yet said the same thing to somebody else. Yeah. That is just so obvious where people do
obvious.
Yeah. It's sad that it still happens and it does still happen. I had other students then, a few haired in, that told me some of their experiences. So when I wrote up my couple of articles that I did in 21, you can look them up. They talked about, you know, having their hair in like what we call like a little afro puff in the back of the head and being told, you can't have your hair like this. She's like, but don't touch my hair. It's off my collar. The fact it's like in a little puff or ball, it's not a problem.
It doesn't mean anything, no.
No. So it's amazing. It still is amazing. I'd even been to like little nursing times things where I've had people come up and like tug on my locks. And I'm like, you know, that is attached to my head. Why would you do that? Why are you touching me? And they kind of do a step back. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was attached to you.
What? Oh my goodness, Georgie. What?
Yeah, people do it. People do it. Yeah, it's very strange phenomenon. And I don't know what it is about black hair that I know people say it's curiosity, but I know that ordinarily you would not walk up to anybody in the street. You wouldn't walk up to somebody when they're pregnant and go, oh, let me just touch your bump, which I know people do, but again, it's not the done thing.
I just wouldn't touch anyone else anyway.
Yes.
Like any part of them, because why would you?
That makes no sense to me. Absolutely none whatsoever. And I just look at it and I'm like, really? This again? I am not a monkey in a sideshow or anything else that you can prod, poke, touch, pull, poke. It's not on. It's really not on.
And I think that situation goes to show, you know, with the student, how having that support is so important. Because, as you said, otherwise he would have, he would have withdrawn or stepped off the programme or not been comfortable going to placement and would have been totally within his right. To feel like that, because that's how he'd been treated. So I think that goes to show for us as academics or lecturers or support staff or ward staff, whoever, that anyone that's listening, the impact that we can have on someone's experience if unfortunately they do come across that type of behaviour or words, that support can be given to the student to keep them, to have that fantastic nurse to be who's now a charge nurse, which we so desperately need, don't we, within the NHS?
You know, we so desperately need the nurses. We need more male nurses, as we know. Yeah. And there's somebody else giving it, oh, you need to do blah. And you need to cut your hair, you need to do that. You know, culturally, it's not sensitive. You know, we talk about cultural competence and our six C's. Well, how can you have cultural competence if you're looking at one nurse saying, put your hair up? Why would you not say the same thing to the other nurse?
Yeah, and how are you in line with our code of professional conduct? You're not.
Yeah.
It's not. Yeah, that goes completely against us and who we are as a profession, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. So I'm glad of that one, and I'm glad of many others.
And that brings us really nicely onto your role now. So you're an associate professor. Mm-hmm. What advice have you got for anyone that is interested in applying, that has that as a career aspiration?
To be an associate professor?
Yeah.
I'd say one, find your niche. Find what you're good at. And then practice that. You know, research it, get involved. And I think it was one of our old deans. I'm going to name drop again here. And I hope you're listening to this, to Jan Williams. Jan once said to me, you know, I was embedded in nursing to get out of nursing. And I for ages thought, what does she mean, get out of nursing? I'm a nurse, can't get out of nursing. Mm-hmm. She didn't mean get out of nursing, because that's your bread and butter. What she was talking about was going out there and networking. Mm-hmm. Meet other people around the university, talk to other departments, see what's going on. Write articles, write what interests you. Do follow the lines of the PhDs or the DProfs or whatever it is that you've got to do, but find your passion. That's the most important thing. Find your passion and stick with it. Sometimes the road's a bit long and you just think, want to jack this all in, but actually there is light at the end of the tunnel. And it's not the same. When I first started nurse teaching, there was 9 HEIs in London. It's not like that anymore. There are so many more teaching hospitals available. There are so many more universities. We are crying out for lecturers, nurse lecturers, any of you out there with those aspirations. You know, try and become, I would even say, try and become an HPL, an hourly paid for a bit. Go and see what it's like. Teaching is very different to being on the wards. On the wards, it's very, very set, don't you think? Academia, I remember when I came in and I was told to go and read, and I went, I can read like here at work. And they were like, well, yes, how else are you going to prep for your lectures? And I was like, oh
okay.
Okay. Yeah. I can go to the library. Yes, I'm allowed to go to the library.
And I'm going to go update that content. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a totally different world, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think apply for some of those roles that are out there. So if there's a program leader stroke cohort leader role, if there is a director of programs role or something like that, something that interests you, give it a whirl, because you know you can only do it for a while, see if you like it. If you like it, fine, see what's the next step. But always have like have a goal in mind, eyes on the prize. If I had said to you when I first started in the 80s, if I would have been an associate professor today, that was like a million miles out of my mind. The only thing in my mind was that mum told me I like cats and kids, go and be a nurse. So I did.
I was going to say, there's been a very big transition from that video store with cats and kids to where you are right now.
It is.
And this leads me perfectly into my next question. Where do you see your career going? What are your aspirations for the future?
Oh, blimey. Well, you know, I did that 100 female women professors, black women professors now with the WEN program. That has been a real eye-opener. And I've met some fantastic black female academics along the route. So I guess at some point I'll be applying for a professorship, I guess. That would be my next obvious stop. I think I will see which way this role takes me, but the road out there is so wide. You know, Laura, there are things that you can get out there that sometimes you sit that you can only dream about and probably didn't even consider. You know, but roles are not fixed now like they were. Jobs are not something that you do from now in the next 30-40 years. I can see myself quite easily within the next 5 to 10 years sitting on a beach in Barbados with a drink in my hand under my favourite coconut tree. Very easily.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, you can come visit.
Yeah, you can send me photos while I'm freezing here.
I guess professorship would be the next thing. So I'm working on that, working on a few projects at the moment. If you're thinking about it, you know, try it. Come and do a bit of teaching. Come and do a bit of networking. You know, never say no. You don't know if you like it until you try it. Some people, it's a perfect fit. Other people, not so much. Keep studying that CPD. Even if you do nothing with it, you always need it for your revalidation. So I think I have been doing that for many years and not even realizing it at the time how crucial it would be. And yeah, suck it and see.
Well, Georgie, thank you so much for giving your time today and for sharing your pearls of wisdom, because there have been so many. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Laura, for having me. It's only taken me 2 years, but hey,
we've got
nothing
there.
Before it's time.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Georgie.
Okay, bye.